listen to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Well, by now you know we're on Full Service Radio because it said so about 20 times. This is Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. Welcome back. We got a great show. You know, those of you that follow us on Sundays here locally in the D.C. area, you know that Foodie and the Beast is more of a variety show. We have, you know, brief segments and probably 5-10 guests.
It's like a party.
It's like a party.
There's lots of food. There's lots of booze. There's lots of drinking. Fun. So
and,
much fun.
And here there's some drinking.
This isn't as much fun.
This is more of a deep dive into a single subject. And today we're tackling a subject of increased interest, and that is the fast casual chains that are growing up locally and around the country that are, I mean, they're not only driving a lot of business, but they're creating sort of a whole new dining out, dining in segment around. We've got Justin Rosenberg in the studio. He's the founder of Honey Grow, which is a plant-based fast casual concept that took root in Philly, and now they're three, right, in D.C.?
Correct.
The D.C. area, right. With more to come. We'll hear about that in a minute.
And also in studio with us is David Katz, his culinary director. I got you. Don't worry.
I was just introducing Justin's the man, and you're the other man.
We got you both. But David, or Katz, as he is referred to by those who really know him and love him.
I saw that musical was terrible. Oy vey.
All right, let's stop. All right. Katz came on Foodie and the Beast a couple Sundays ago and really was able to tell us about this Honey Grow concept, which is new to D.C. in like the last year and a half, right?
Year and a half.
So we really just were very interested in how an outsider enters into the D.C. market. It does not always bode well for like big names in the regular restaurant industry. And given all the loyalty to the fast casual concepts here, like Sweetgreen and Am Pizza and Beefsteak, etc., you know, how does Honey Grow enter the market? But before we get like way into it, why don't we get a little 411? Justin, I'd love to hear how Honey Grow came to be.
How Honey Grow grew.
Yes. How did Honey Grow grow?
Plant-based.
We're not plant-based.
We planted a seed.
Hey now.
Yes.
I had to do that. Okay. All right. So
do you want to curse and get it out of the way?
Do you want to just do it?
No, I got to be good today.
Okay.
Well, it'll come out eventually. Well, try to give the succinct version. It's always fun hearing your voice when you have a
It's the worst.
Hi. Yeah, so my background, I'm from New York. Grew up on Long Island. I'm one of those guys.
No. Sorry.
We never would have guessed.
Really?
Kidding.
No.
Really? Oh, there you go.
You don't have a Philly accent.
Nope, not from Philly.
Right.
Went to Penn State undergrad. I was a history major and a Spanish minor, so my brain's always been on the creative side. Had my band back in the day in high school. So music's always been my big passion.
And Is this guy the replication of me? I'm a history major and I was in a band. Look at us.
Because you haven't gotten any series anything. So no.
You just don't look like Brad Pitt like I do.
Yeah, exactly. Difference.
I look like Brad Armpit.
Anyway, so moved to Philadelphia, had a job opportunity at a chocolate factory, Frankfurt Chocolate on Washington Avenue.
No kidding.
It's a pretty awesome job. Went from like, you know, decent weight to 240 pounds, something crazy. And ultimately was very fascinated by real estate, just development and acquisition of it. Got a job with a boutique multifamily firm that was purchasing real estate throughout the country. So I was the 23-year-old kid that was thrown out to Denver to help buy apartment buildings. And it was very interesting. But then I wanted to kind of learn more. So I got a job at a place called Pennsylvania Real Estate Investment Trust. Mm-hmm. I was a financial analyst, oversaw a portfolio of a bunch of shopping malls, went to school at night for my MBA in finance at Temple. Excuse me, I'm getting over this.
That's impressive because history majors are notoriously bad in math.
I wasn't good at math, and then I said I have to get good at math because it was a very obvious weakness, and I said I need to master this. So I don't know how or why Preet hired me as an analyst, but they did. And very quickly, I learned finance, and I learned accounting, and I learned all the stuff that you need to know running a business. And right before I graduated, I had this thing inside of me, which was, I really want to start my own business. I really want to start my own company. And for me, my passion besides music has always really been food. I found myself, you know, reading back in the day, like a surfer magazine, And I like to surf. And, you know, one of the things I always like...
Because you did so much of that in Long Island.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Long Island has some decent waves. Jones Beach, Robert mm-hmm. Moses.
She was being facetious.
I know, but I have to defend
serious.
My life.
She was, I was totally being serious.
I called
serious.
Her those waves there.
4, 5, 6 footers are not bad.
Okay.
But, yeah, so wound up thinking, like, I read these surf magazines, and an example, I'd be reading that, but I used to get even more enjoyment reading about what the surfers were eating and where they were going in different countries and what they were getting. And, you know, for me, food's always really been a big passion of mine, and it's very big in my family, especially growing up in New York, getting to a bunch of restaurants in Brooklyn and the city. So that's really been a passion. So I said, hey, you know what? Like, I really, if I want to do a business, I think it should be around food. And at the time, I was vegan. I read this book, The China Study, which scared the shit out of me mm-hmm. about eating animal products. So I adopted a plant-based diet, and I was making a lot of salads for lunch and making stir-fry for dinner. So all the stuff I prep during the day, all this, you know, stuff for salads.
Chopping.
Yeah, I'd be throwing it into a saute pan or a wok at night and with buckwheat noodles and tossing it up, and just, you know, that would be my stir-fry. So did the research. At the time, it was really like Chipotle, Panera, all these other older concepts. You mentioned a few concepts. I don't think M Pizza was around yet. I think Sweetgreen just started. And I didn't want to be another salad concept because you had chopped and tossed and mixed greens and sweet green and salad mm-hmm. works and blah, mad greens and dock greens and who
sour
gives a
greens.
Shit?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, it was kind of like...
There's been a pendulum swing on the salads, though, don't you think? I mean, I hate to interrupt you, but since you brought up all those salad concepts, not all of them are still around.
Correct. But you have so many that are still wanting to be in the game. So you have right. a lot of new guys coming into the game thinking, hey,
I can do this better.
I can do this better than them, or I can do it just as good and make a lot of money, which I think is the wrong reason to be in the business.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to do just another salad concept, because when I was going into these places, they were more geared towards a female demographic. It was more lunchtime oriented. How do I create something that I can get both male and female to come in? How do I get something that can get you to want to come back, not just once a week, but, you know, or sorry, twice a week, but twice a day? And how can I get something that you'd actually want to get for dinner? So again, I thought, hey, like, after doing this research, like, this is pretty unique. It's different. The closest thing at the time is like a Mongolian barbecue in the Midwest or down south or maybe out west. And I want to do something a bit more concise.
They were so big in the 80s.
They're good. used to go to one in Penn State. Shout out to Green Bowl. But so that was really it. Wrote a business plan, came up with the name Honey Grow, playing words, honest eating, grown local,
mm-hmm.
and knew I needed to raise capital. You know, I'm not getting it from a bank or mommy and daddy, so I got to figure this out. And I gave myself 2 years. I said, look, if I can't get this thing financed in 2 years by the end of 2011, then forget it. I'll move back to New York and be in finance and I'll be fine.
But what was this thing? What was the initial concept of Honey Grow? Was it salads? Was it stir fries? Was it both? I mean, for people who don't know what Honey Grow is,
sure.
I think you need to explain what the initial concept was, and then we can get into the involvement into yep. what it is today.
Yeah. So Honey Grow from the beginning was, the idea was, you're taking a bunch of ingredients and it's a wholesome foods concept, fast casual. And you could either make a stir fry with it or you could make a salad with it.
Okay.
And essentially, that's what I was eating every single day. And I mm-hmm. thought, you know what? Like, I could eat this every single day. I really enjoy it. People love noodles. People love creating their own stuff.
But Honey Grow isn't vegan. I mean, you can go
not
vegan if you want to, but there are proteins.
Correct. I didn't want to limit the concept into being strictly plant-based, just mm-hmm. thinking that most people, like, I'm not trying to push a diet on anybody. So mm-hmm. I knew that, hey, like, if you want to get beef, pork, or chicken in a stir fry, go for it. You know, that's mm-hmm. pretty cool. There's certain things we wouldn't serve, but ultimately that was fine. So long story short, wrote the business plan and needed two things. Experience, because no one's going to invest in some fucking kid who doesn't know what he's doing with a restaurant.
Well, right. But wait, so you work down here?
Correct.
At Rustico?
Correct.
Who did you work for?
Steve Menino.
You did work for Steve Menino.
Yeah.
I know Steve Menino.
Steve introduced me through a mutual person, and I met Steve, and I was just beyond impressed with what he can do.
But did you have to go through Neighborhood Restaurant Group, or you just went to Steve and said?
I went to Steve.
Yeah.
I was basically, you're not getting paid, don't fuck it up. And I was like, all right, heard. So got in the kitchen. The first day I was there, I fucked up. I'll never forget.
You left a thumb in the French fries?
No, it was something super, super simple. It was like, ticket came up, and you know, Steve's the exec chef, and Steve's a genius in what he does, and he's an intimidating guy. He's a big dude, and he's no bullshit, so you mm-hmm. better get it done. And ticket came up, and I'm in my own world. I'm kind of like looking around like, wow, I'm in this kitchen. Wow, it's so cool. It's the weekend. So I'd work 5 days a week and then take the bus down to D.C. to work for Steve because I respected him so much and and said, hey, like, I want to learn on this guy. So ticket comes up. I hear, Justin, ticket. Justin, ticket. And it's like kind of like in and out of my head. And you're, Justin, get the fucking ticket. I'm like, oh my God. And now I'm in the restaurant business.
Right.
And that was a bad night. It was just one of those nights where, like, you know, I couldn't get things done fast enough. I didn't know what I was doing. The staff looked at me like I was the class fuck up. And I was just, it was like, man, like, I really messed this up. And I felt bad because I didn't want to embarrass Steve, because everyone, you know, knew me as Steve's, like, guy. And, you know, I didn't want to make him look bad. And I definitely feel bad because I may have.
So how long did you work for Steve?
About, you know, 6 months. And I would do 2 weekends on, 1 weekend off.
Mm-hmm.
And I would basically, eventually I got my confidence. Like, I would come in. So Friday night, we'd do dinner rush. And then I'd come back Saturday morning and do prep. And then I would do Saturday night dinner rush. And when I could, I'd stay for Sunday morning brunch. And I'd take the bus back. I had a 1-year-old daughter, at the 2-year-old daughter at the time.
Your wife must have loved this. Oh, she must have
loved that.
Well, her boyfriend was over all the time.
Okay, so that worked. Oh.
So, no, my wife was definitely...
Plus, he was the mailman. He was there anyways, right?
Yeah. Not on Sundays. But that's why I got home. Now, so, you know, it was a tough time for all of us. You know, my wife definitely understood and understood my passion to get this done.
Mm-hmm.
And I also really wanted to learn under somebody that knew what they were really doing, and so I can get that experience. So it was great to work under Steve. And then... I had to find capital. That was the other thing. So I had a business plan, not from Philadelphia. I spent the last X years behind the computer in a cubicle. So I didn't really network that much. So I had to get out there. And I pitched 94 people over about a 2-year period. And it was a pretty humbling time. So people like, oh, well, you know, you have technology in your concept. And we use touchscreens
right.
for ordering. And, you know, one of the big things for us is...
And that
is,
was very new. Because I think I went to one of your original ones in Philadelphia. And that was the first time I saw a touchscreen as an ordering process. And I was like, well, this is very fancy.
So Wawa and Sheetz, they've had it, I think, since 04 or 05.
Okay. And we just got a Wawa here and people have lost their minds.
It's the one in DuPont?
It's a convenience store, people. Get over it. Move on.
People fucking love Wawa.
I mean, I don't...
I love Wawa.
I get it, but, like, we're going to lose our minds over a fucking Wawa opening up down here? Give me a break.
People love Wawa. I think their interface sucks. I think the UX and
their food sucks.
Total dog shit.
Thank you. And it's a convenience store that has food.
But the kiosks are functional. I'll give them that. So for me, it was kind of like, you know, the business problem that I had was, if you wanted a salad and I wanted a stir fry,
mm-hmm.
if you do the traditional assembly line model, where like a Chipotle, where you go to the line and pick and choose, it's not going to work for Honeygrow, because, you know, you're going to wait for your stir fry. You're not going to know where to stand. I also ordered a salad. It'd be very confusing. So the alternative would be more like a Shake Shack or a Starbucks or a Panera, where you order your stuff and then you wait. But I was worried if I ordered through one person, they're going to forget all the ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of options. And so it wasn't kind of clean. I wanted something that was really simple, clean, and beautiful. I've always been an Apple fanboy. So to me, it was like, have a beautiful design aesthetic, make it simple, make it functional. And that's why we have those kiosks.
Mm-hmm.
So spent a lot of time trying to raise money. Finally met a guy. He met a guy who just sold a marketing company, loved my deck. Was like, you know what? Let me introduce you to an attorney friend of mine. I said, cool. Met this guy. He's like, not for me, but I think I might know somebody. I play tennis with this guy, and, you know, he might be interested. This guy, his name's David Robkin, and David's partners with Stephen Starr, and he was one of the original investors, I believe, in ConMetal and Budokan. And David is an accountant by trade, also a venture capitalist by trade.
And a tennis player.
And he's a tennis player. And
is that key for a reason?
No, Dave Katz. You
know, well, it means he's got balls.
But I'm bummed.
I would give Robkin that. David definitely has balls to invest in a guy who's never done anything with restaurants and had no business at the time doing anything with restaurants. But, you know, David, he has a lot of foresight and might have been nuts to invest in me. But, you know, David, he understood what I was trying to do. And I think, unlike what Steven's done, which has been incredible, Steven has 30, 40 different concepts, and mm-hmm. it's just amazing to be able to worry about all that and still execute at the level he can. Whereas my goal was to build something more in line with, say, a Starbucks, where it's one concept, we could perfect it over the years, and you're building enterprise value
and
throughout
print it
the process.
Out. Right.
And you print it out. So he was attracted to that. He brought on a person he did business with in the past, Brooklyn Fest, and Brooke and David were my two original investors, and opened up the first location. And
where was the first location in Philly?
Center City, Philadelphia.
Okay.
Fucked everything up tremendously. Had a second kid 3 weeks into opening.
Two babies at once.
Good planning.
Yeah. It was, you know, life's good. And, you know, basically it was these two guys now asking themselves probably, well, definitely, what the hell do we get ourselves involved with here with this
guy?
Well,
how much was the first investment?
$1 million. So for a million bucks, like.
For just the first brick and mortar, correct?
Correct. So I raised additional
capital.
And
where did you test your recipes? I mean, when did cats come in?
Cats came in later on. So cats, you
so
can...
So we're not to you yet. You're just going to have to wait. Just
well, is it true that there are always cats hanging out the back door of a restaurant? Is that...
Okay, stop it.
No, not true. So, no, the original recipes were mine. I mean,
they were all yours? But, yep. Like, where did you test them? Or I had just serving them to your wife and kids? How did that go down?
I had a chef consultant for a hot second. Didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And then, ultimately, I did exactly that. I had friends, family, anyone that was willing to try anything. Mm-hmm. And, ultimately, it just... The consensus was, this is good, this is not good, whatever. Opened up and didn't have the right product yet. We needed to find the right noodles. That was a huge thing. We opened up with the wrong noodles. And
opened up with the wrong noodles?
Yeah, it took me a while. I went throughout to all my favorite ramen places throughout New York asking, hey, where do you guys get your noodles from? And nobody really wanted to tell some kid.
Well, don't they get most of their noodles from Japan?
From Japan, they make it. There's certain vendors that have it. So finally I found, you know, the right partners for us on noodles. That was game changing. Mm-hmm. So finally we had a fresh egg white noodle. We developed a fresh whole wheat noodle, right recipes, right team. So by October, 4 months into it, it clicked. And simultaneously I convinced my two partners to invest another $1 million into a second location in Balakinwood. Mm-hmm. And they were like, okay.
That's suburbia?
Yeah.
Isn't there one like on...
No, Balakinwood's out near...
City Ave.
City Ave. That's the one I've been to.
Yeah, so that's the second location.
Okay.
So I opened that one in January. So I opened the first one June 8th, 2012. Mm-hmm. I opened the second one. It was January 17th, 2013.
Okay.
And over that 7-8 month period, I lived in the restaurant. My first GM, this is like, you know, the restaurant business under fire, trial under fire. My first GM was like, you know, leaving the safe open, disappearing, you know, all the bullshit and, you know... We ended up firing her once the baby was born and healthy. And I said, you know what? I'm running this place day and night. So I was the GM. So it was great. I did everything imaginable in the restaurant. And then when the second location came, I hired my team. I knew what I was doing. We had the right product, the right systems. And I ran the second restaurant for a while. And I really perfected it, which, you know, was looking back some of the best days of my life. It was so much fun to like have a concept. You're beginning to really see it have wings and take off. And about, you know, that year we won Best of Philly in, I think it was Philadelphia Magazine. So that was a huge small milestone, but it was a big deal. You know,
what did you win for? Best New Restaurant?
I think it was like Best New something. It was
because Fast Casual wasn't even a term yet. I feel like Fast Casual has really caught on maybe like 2014-ish.
There's like different ways of it. You have your like, you know, your original guys like Chipotle and Panera and, you know.
I know, but when Panera and Chipotle started, they were still mega giants. Like they weren't independent. I think Chipotle was originally independent from Denver, maybe, right?
Correct.
So, and then they got bought and they just like, you know, rubber stamped it across the country. So they're a chain. And David said chain earlier, and I kind of cringe because, I mean, even though it is in essence what you are, I just feel like it's more of a homegrown concept.
I used to get so pissed off when people would tweet when we had one restaurant. Oh, it's some chain from California. It's like, we're not a fucking chain. Like,
right.
It was like, my restaurant was my baby. I'm working my ass off. And we're doing a lot more than what a chain restaurant. We're not opening bags of shit and throwing it.
Right.
Into,
well, like, you know. That's my point with Panera and Chipotle. Like, there's nothing organic or authentic about what they're doing. They have a business model. They can churn cash. No two ways about it. People go to them.
Right.
But there's nothing... you know, local, or they're not working with local people, like all that. Anything that they do is spin.
There's a level of thought that's just not there.
Right.
And I think that you're right. I think there's like, oh, we're, you know, we're going to do some cool commercial and we're going to do a billboard that says eat from scratch. And it's all fucking bullshit. And so for us, it was for me personally, it's like I didn't want to create something that wasn't real from the inside. So.
But I think initially what they were to people is an alternative to fast food, right? So we've gone from the McDonald's and the Wendy's and I don't know. Whatever.
And now they're trying to be more.
They're
like,
trying to.
You know,
I mean, they're so caught up
in salads and you
they're
know,
so caught off
we're
guard.
We're gonna have real eggs really soon.
I know. So,
wow.
But they're totally caught off guard. Right. I mean, but McDonald's owns Chipotle, right?
Not anymore. No.
Oh, they don't. Okay.
No. The founder of Chipotle bought it back, didn't he?
Right.
Right. So and they more or less yes, and then they're publicly traded.
Right. But they.
Company.
But I think that's why they were so alluring initially, because they're like, oh, this is fast, ish,
and it's casual,
but it's healthier. You know, it's not burgers and fries.
Yeah.
And you can see people preparing it; they're not behind some wall where you can't see what's going on back there.
Yeah.
And I think that gave people some sort of it was sort of the gateway drug to your concept, because it allowed people to recognize that they could spend a little bit more. on a fast concept. It didn't have to be $1.99 for a burger, shake, and fries. You could get something fresh. You could get something prepared in front of you.
Yep.
And you could eat healthier.
And it's a higher quality. Like, look at Shake Shack, for example. So
Shake Shack's, like, that's such a the whole thing is so crazy.
Like, 2004, I think, is when they launched in Madison Square Park.
Yep.
And prior to that, I think Five Guys was beginning to really blow up.
Mm-hmm. And they're from here originally.
Yep.
Yeah, DC guys. And, you know, you look at Shake Shack, it's a really high-quality burger. I mean, they're buying... I mean, Dave knows those guys pretty well. I know those Shake Shack guys as well. They're good guys.
I feel like we have to get Dave another drink.
You want another drink? Catch us, crush that.
Dude. I'm here for the drinks.
What'd you have?
Old Fashioned.
Yeah, you had the same thing as me.
Yeah, except you had rye, right? You had bourbon.
I had the Four Roses. Huh? It's good.
You remember that Cheech and Chong bit, Dave's not here? I was worried that after that drink, he might...
Dave's here.
Dave's here. I think Dave's fine.
Dave's all right. So, no, I think that what Shake Shack did really well was they had a higher quality product. They had better branding than anyone else in the burger category.
They
for
had
a while.
Danny Myers.
They had Danny Meyer, who's a fine dining person,
right?
And therefore, you had your credibility. And I think they did a great job with that. And I think a lot of the better fast casual guys have figured out how to do all those variables, not necessarily have a Danny Meyer in the background, but to have a better quality product, tell that story, tell that narrative, and simultaneously have a really good brand that people actually buy into.
Yeah, but isn't the challenge? Because Shake Shack is great, but the challenge as you... I'm thinking more now about the people that are trying to emulate Wolfgang Puck,
right,
who want to be in every airport and have restaurants everywhere. The bigger you get, the less control you, the founder, have.
Right.
The less reliable, maybe, or maybe not, is the sourcing and the preparation and the presentation and all that. So doesn't it at some point just become you're just pounding out what may be a good product but may not be a good product depending on whether it's in Omaha or Philly?
Right. I think the hardest thing to do is, if you want to grow a concept, you still want to make sure that what made you special in the beginning, and this is hard, but what made you special in the beginning can last at scale. And I think what makes you special in the beginning is an authentic connection with the people that are coming in. You have a great product that's consistently executed, and you're creating these awesome experiences over and over and over again. And I think it's hard, you know, like, any one of us in our space, name a concept who's growing, if they're telling you they're not having challenges with making sure they can emulate or
consistency,
replicate the consistency or the experience that they created in their first few stores, they're lying to you. They're full of shit. And
well, I also think it's getting the people who work for you on board.
Right.
You know, in DC, you know, first of all, I'm sure it's the same thing in Philadelphia or wherever else you're opening up. I mean, finding staff right now is next to impossible. Because
it's hardest thing.
Right? There's no staffing. I mean, Katz, I'm sure you can talk about that. But, like, right now, how do you get people on board to be... When I go up and order, even though I order at a kiosk...
Doesn't matter.
The people behind there are your ambassadors.
Yeah.
And how do you get them to be
on board,
excited about your product and about being there?
It's hard. There's so many answers to this one. It starts from the top. So you want to make sure that, you know, your district manager is excellent and has a certain personality. You need to be always hiring leaders. You want to find people who are role models, people who are willing to go the extra mile, people who buy into the concept, breathe the vision, and can build a team of people that will do the same thing. That's fucking hard, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it's 1,000% what we worry about and what we focus on. And we're not batting 1,000. We've made our mistakes. We make our mistakes. Don't get me wrong. And one of the challenges with Honeygrow versus a lot of the other concepts, we're cooking food made to order. So
right, as opposed to just chopping up a salad.
Precisely. And you are timing noodles and you're looking while you're sautéing and making sure all the ingredients in there. A lot of things can go wrong. So you need to have very strong processes and really good people. So it's relentless. I mean, we have people from our fast casual competitors and peers coming in, trying to steal our staff nonstop.
Oh, I bet.
And it's flattering, but, you know, it's just...
Stop.
Just get the fuck out. Like, okay. Or we'll do the same to you and whatever. So, and that's fine. It's just part of the game. And that's cool. But the question then becomes, how do you retain your good people?
Right.
And it's just, you know, it's how do you keep anyone that's good? Just, you have to pay them, you know, well, make sure you're taking care of them. Making sure they have open dialogue with people above them so they can vent their frustrations and we can actually hear them and listen to them. There's a lot involved with that. So focusing on your people, anyone that, you know, there are a lot of people say they do those things, but I think the secret to success is obviously great products, you know, but you need a really solid team of people who want to be coached and who are coachable and are leaders to take it to the next level.
Let's bring Katz into this because, first of all, he'll pass out if we let him just sit there and drink.
I don't think he's going to pass out. I think he's, you know, waiting for his next cocktail.
David, you're part of that too, right? I mean, you're part of that whole, you know, particularly on the cooking side, keeping up the team spirit and making sure people aren't dropping the ball. And do you guys, because now you have properties down here, are you constantly on the train visiting your properties and going back and forth between here and Philly?
Cats?
Yeah.
You can't nod on the radio. You got to say
dude,
yes.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know if you're asking Justin that. No. Yeah, definitely. I mean, both of us do. Justin hustles like crazy as well to get, you know, to get down here in Chicago and Pittsburgh and Boston, you know, to get inside of the restaurants. I do it, you know. We're, yeah, definitely constantly, you know, coaching and trying to stay inspiring, you know, to the people that are making the food every day. It's not an easy job, you know.
So,
well, why did you bring cats in if you were behind all the recipes? And you
really, why?
Why? Tell us.
We're just every day.
A lot of people asking that question.
Okay, cats, if something goes wrong after this interview, just don't blame us, okay?
No.
We can find, we'll find you work here at
no worries.
Neighborhood Restaurant Group. Don't worry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Take care of you.
So, because I'm not a chef, and I knew I can get somebody on board who's way better than me at recipes and food. And I knew Dave's restaurant name. I didn't personally know Dave.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fun story by itself, how we met. But Maybe it was a fucking amazing restaurant.
Is it like a meat cute? Is it a meat cute story?
No, sorry, what?
Oh, no. Like a cute, like a little love story, how you guys met?
Yeah,
park bench.
I was, yeah, exactly.
Nightclub.
Sharing a bag of fries
right.
On a bench.
Who bought who the drink? That's all I want to know.
We were sharing a milkshake with two straws.
Holding
hands.
This
at Shake Shack. Yeah. We're having a concrete together.
Right. We had a few moments of eye contact.
Nothing wrong with that.
Right.
Exactly. Then we realized we were each Jewish, and then it was on from there.
Right. You're Jewish? My mom would be very happy with this.
Oh, my God, we have a room full of Jews.
Let's have a bar mitzvah.
Flanzer over there is Jewish.
Flanzer,
Courtney,
yeah.
What up?
Oh,
what up,
my
Courtney?
God.
Hey, now.
All right. Now, the problem is all the Jew haters out there.
Yeah, I know. You're not
just
helping
they
us,
just
guys.
Turned
two words, fuck you. So that's
what? Oh, yeah. I think we have like a president Jew hater. I think,
yes, we do.
Anyway.
Oh, that's a whole other show.
Oh, that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, we're in D.C.
Oh, wow.
How about that? So how do we meet?
Courtney, should I go down this road or no?
No. You just killed the whole food.
I am controlling the show. Right. And we have to take a break.
PR person always tells me,
yeah, let's go back to
events. Do not mention politics. I'm like,
right.
Okay.
Well, wait.
No, I mean, we can mention politics, but if we do, then we're not going to be able to talk about honey grow.
No, let's
I
go back to food. Well done steaks and ketchup and
okay.
Big Macs, right? Is that what you eat? Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly.
He's not coming to your restaurant. We're all thrilled.
No,
let's move
not.
On.
Yeah.
Okay, so at what point did you bring him on board?
So,
yeah, Justin.
Yes. So I'd say two and a half years. So Dave was working with Creekstone Farms. We were buying a lot of our product from La Frida Meats.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave came in one day with our La Frida rep, Dave being from Creekstone. And I'm like, Dave Katz, like, you had Maymay, right? And Dave's like, yep. So we started talking, had a little bit of a love fest. I was at the time GM of the Balakima location.
Okay.
And I said to Dave, and I'm like, yo, man.
I love how you call yourself the GM, even though you own both concepts.
Yeah.
But you were working.
I worked my ass off.
I hear you.
I miss
man.
Those days. It was fun. But my car was
I'm sure your wife and children miss them too.
It's the same. They never see me either way. I'm just never home. So bad. But, you know, Dave.
That's also another show. We'll get to that one later.
Yeah, you can meet the kids at their bar mitzvahs. Don't worry. You'll be fine.
I have three, maybe four. No, I have three, I think. So Dave, I said to him, you know, at the time we didn't raise any money. We raised actually at that point in time, we had the two restaurants. We had a Series B. Someone finally came to us and said, hey, we want to put some money into this. We raised $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew, we were in talks to raise more capital. And, I said, Dave, like, you know, if we do this, I'd love to have you on board as a culinary director. Like the day we, you know, met and then, you know.
So what?
That's already a year later, Dave.
So
yeah,
Dave, once later. He brought you on board, what did you, were you like? Yeah, I got to get in here and I got to fix some things, or what was it that you needed to do?
We're going to take a
break. You know what? We're going to take a break.
Awesome.
When we come back, we'll start with you.
Oh, you'll find out.
Right? Exactly. This
you'll
is David and
out.
Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be back in just a sec. We'll be right back.
like that music. I tell you, it's like a soft jazz show. You're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. David Katz, let's go back to you because, you know.
Culinary director.
Culinary director. So here's my question, because I'm sitting listening to Justin lay out his vision and he was running the first two restaurants. So what do you need a culinary director for? What did you do when you came in?
Nobody can see you doing that, just so you know, because we're on radio.
Oh, I know. It's just a little inside thing.
No, but okay. You should tell the story when you were sitting with me at Cherry Hill before you joined. You're sitting there with Tony. Oh, it's like giving you the hardcore press.
Yeah. So the second meeting, Justin referenced the first meeting at the Bala Cynwyd restaurant before he raised some money. And, you know, that's when he threw out the first, hey, I want you to be my culinary director at some point. And I was like, yeah, sure. Of course. You know, I was like, we'll talk. You know, I was in the middle of some fucking sales job that was like I had sold my restaurant after 5 years and I took this sales job for a farm in Kansas. Good stuff, Creekstone, great beef, great company. But it was like a bridge job.
We've had them on Foodie and the Beast.
Yeah, you told me that before. Mm-hmm. That's cool, yeah. And I said, I'm scared to ask who, and I'm saying it again. But
okay,
no.
I can't remember.
No, but it's cool. It was a good experience. So I was there, like Justin said, on like a sales call with the Lafrida guy. We're plugging Lafrida like crazy, like they need more plugs. But so
the
anyway,
are based in Union, New Jersey, and
North Bergen,
operators are on duty now.
Yeah, Pat Lafrida, butcher to the stars. Yeah, Pat's a great guy. If you're listening, Pat, and all of his fans. He's but anyway,
we're gonna send this to Pat so he can.
Yeah, absolutely, okay. Pat. That's a great company. So anyway. Lafrida was the main distributor for Creekstone. That's why I used to ride around with the Creekstone rep, Tony Macaroni. Shouts to Tony Macaroni, by the way.
Oh, my God. Wait, seriously?
His name's Macaroni.
No, we're never going to get to
the story. But clearly
we're
going to call him Macaroni.
I know. You got to finish the story.
Hey, wait. Vinny Boombatz. Yeah.
I got more Tony Macaroni stories, but we don't have time.
Like eating a McMuffin in one bite.
In two bites. Yeah. Love he probably story. Could do it in one bite, but two bites. That is a good story. So, anyway, I was with Tony Mac, and I ran in, you know, I saw Justin at Bala Cynwyd. He planted the seed about culinary director stuff. We should talk. And I'm like, that's cool because I'm already fucking bored with this job. So fast forward another year and I was really bored with the job. And I met Justin again in his fourth Honey Grow, which is in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And so I'm in there with Tony. Basically what Justin's asking me to tell, which is pretty funny, is we're sitting at a four top and it's me and Tony. And I'm sitting across from Justin and Tony's sitting across from like a GM or somebody else that works with Honey Grow at the time, some mid-level decision maker or something. But Justin was
okay, dude. You got to get to the story because the show's almost over.
Okay, and Justin brought up the culinary director thing.
This is what
to
I get
again.
At home, by the way. So
I'm very impatient.
No, I know. I have to condense my minute and a half.
Yeah,
I'm
so
sorry.
Let's do it.
So Justin's, you know, was like, we're talking business. Tony's trying to sell beef. And Justin sitting across from me like, hey, man, we should talk about this culinary director thing. Let's go out to dinner. But like right in front of Tony, the guy didn't exactly work for him or with the same company. But it was like just like shamelessly like, yo,
Justin.
Let's talk. Yeah. So then, you know, we went out to dinner and a couple times and talked. And
okay, but
I became the culinary director. That's it. My time's up.
No. But as the culinary director, what do you do? If he already had the recipes and he already knew.
That was my point. What did you change?
What did you change? Like, how'd you come in and take over?
There was a core menu there. I came in one of the first things.
Did you screw with some of the sauces?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this could be better. We could do this. We can take
well, David,
out of that.
Well, David, why don't you tell us about that?
Okay. Yeah, definitely. My first look was kind of checking out what was already being done within their recipe book and not exactly making any menu changes right away, but taking like sauces, dressings, methods, and kind of tightening them up a little bit, you know, and making like a certain sauce or a certain dressing a little different, a little better.
All right, well, so let me ask Justin, did you get pissed off because he's coming in? You brought him in, but
did
now
you
he's,
have any pride
now
of authorship?
He's fucking around with your
no,
children.
He asked me to.
I think Dave was really respectful to that, and I'm a control freak. I'm an entrepreneur. But I knew Dave's talent, and I think Dave was very respectful. So, look, I could kind of wrap it up. I would say that anyone, Chappelle Show,
of course, wrap it up.
Oh my God, we're just gonna give you guys your own show. Call it a day.
We talked about that.
Okay.
But Katzenberg. So No, I think there was a lot of things that Dave came in, like onion, for example. We were dicing onion up. Dave's like, well, why don't we use this piece of equipment instead? So he added a lot of that. But from the recipe standpoint, you know, we had a Philly roast pork stir fry for a while. I mean, that creative side, things that I wouldn't even have thought of, adding different ingredients to the mix, from salads to stir fry. I mean, one of the things I said to Dave when he first started, I said, I think our salads are good. They're not great. And I think our competitors might be better than us. Let's own that fact. I want you to make them, you know, these salads better. How do you do that? You know, how do you make our stir fries? They're really good. Make them excellent. What could we be doing a bit better? So Dave really explored the ingredients, start playing with stuff.
Well, let's talk about the ingredients a little bit. You know, not everybody trumpets local. It doesn't have to be. And not everybody trumpets organic. But since your concept is overall healthy, what is what's your take on the product that you bring in?
My take is I'm extraordinarily proud of it. You know, I would never want to serve something that I or my family wouldn't eat. The reason why we buy local is, quite frankly, just tastes better. I mean, my family,
So are you working with the farmers? Who are you working with? How are you bringing in local product? And are you doing local, like, as you expand into all these different markets, how do you create the same relationships?
Well, plus seasonality affects what you're doing too, right?
Yep. So back in the day, it was really easy to just buy parsley and cilantro at the Rittenhouse Market or at the Ardmore Farmers Market or the parking lot farmer's shit across the street because it was there, it was easy. Or we used to buy, back in the day, from Dickinson College, this beautiful organic romaine from a hydroponic farm. It was like glowing green. It was the most beautiful thing ever. So fast forward today, what do you do? That's where Dave really comes in terms of the sourcing purveyors. We have other people on our team now that really help out with that as well. And, you know, we can't be doing those things anymore, right? It's just virtually impossible. What you can do is work with farmer aggregators like Common Market, who amazing company that we work with. They purchase from farmers directly. They'll aggregate the product and then distribute it to restaurants, hospitals, schools. So we work with a few of those type of organizations. You know, Dave, you take lead in this.
Yeah, I mean, we do that for sure. And then some of our kind of more broadline produce, you know, vendors also deal in a lot of local foods nowadays, which is great. I mean, a few years back, if you just bought from your kind of run-of-the-mill produce company, they were only dealing in commodity products. But now they've all kind of upped their game. And as you can get just, you know, bagged onions, commodity onions and stuff, they also spread their wings and they buy a lot locally. So between the sources that Justin mentioned and then just our kind of like, our workhorse vendors that just get all of our produce, they have a pretty big local list as well. And we look at that and meet with them and, you know, and kind of cherry pick what they're doing locally and get it through them as well. So we definitely have the ability in all of our regions so far, to bring in a good amount of local stuff. So
is that something that you feel as part of your mission you really trumpet? Would you say it like, as Honeygrow breaks into the DC market? I mean, I know you have three shops here, but as you break in, is that part of your main mission or your main message, excuse me?
You know, it is, and it's something I don't think we communicate enough of. You know, it's one of those things where the reason why we're doing it is more important than anything else. I think, especially today, for the past 3-4 years, so many people are jumping on the local bullshit train because it's cool and that's what
they think.
Oh, I think
it's been more than 3 or 4 years.
Well, casual, I'm saying.
In the fast casual space, absolutely.
Yeah. No, it's
been
going
on forever. But it's a trickle
down,
right? But it's been a real trickle down effect.
Well, you go to any restaurant in Napa and they've been doing that forever. So right. I was at Bottega, you know, a year plus ago.
Larry Forgione in New York, forever.
There you go. And, you know, you're eating something so colorful and vibrant and beautiful. And the story, the bartender's telling me, like, I'm like, dude, what farm? He's like, oh, it's like a quarter mile down the street. Like, there's nothing more beautiful than that. And it just tastes so good. So if we're not doing that a quarter mile away, but if we could do something where in a fast casual setting, the vibrancy, the color, the taste is there. And because it's local, then we're going to buy local. And that's something I'm very proud of. And I don't think we talk enough about. We don't talk enough about.
And do you think it's as important to your consumer?
I think it is. I think that the consumers that we want to attract appreciate good food and they're appreciating where it's coming from. And look, my wife, for example, mom of three kids, like she wants to know where everything is coming from. And I think transparency, especially today, is critical. And quite frankly, it really differentiates the better fast casual brands than anyone else or any company that's being transparent. It could be retail, it could be tech, it could be restaurant. Like the companies that are not transparent, you don't really want to work with them because you simply don't trust them.
Well, I was going to say, it really is about trust. So if right. I know that your message is that, look, we work with local whenever we can and right. we try to bring in the best product we can, I'm not going to start looking at everything you're doing because I already trust you. I right. already know what you're doing, and I know when I come in, I'm going to be able to get something healthy. My kids are going to be able to get something healthy, and you know, we're going to have a good meal
exactly.
with, you know, as much local product as possible, but also just healthy.
Right, and I think great brands can create that level of trust. Think about Apple. Like back in the day, you know, with iTunes, and you're setting up your iTunes account on your phone, like, you had to trust that company with your credit card information.
Right, totally.
And they were one of the first companies that really did that.
And now we just give out our credit card to everybody.
Terms and conditions?
David, sure. I'll give you mine later.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
You're welcome.
Exactly. Of course I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, the flip side of that is, and the risk for all of them is, you destroy that trust in one way or another once, and you're dead as a doornail.
You don't get trust back.
That's right.
I don't care what anyone says. Once that trust level is gone, that's it.
That's like Chipotle is a great example.
Chipotle is a fantastic example.
Because they've had several yeah. misses. They sort of got a little bit back, but then they had another miss. And yeah. I just...
Great example. Great book that... shout out to Stacy, who works for us, our VP of marketing, who came from Chipotle.
Mm-hmm.
She's probably cringing as I speak, but recommended a fantastic book to me. Jim Collins, How the Mighty Fall. Mm-hmm. And it talked about the different phases of what makes a company kind of that's been kind of up top, go to the bottom. And I think one of those things after reading the book that I can see in Chipotle, and I'll just say it, I think they've done amazing things. I mean, they were really groundbreaking for fast casual. Like they've
Absolutely.
Done incredible things, but sometimes hubris, I think, gets in the way. And there was a lot of opportunity to fix it, and it just didn't happen.
Well, let me ask you both a question. At what point, I don't know if you're already doing this, but is there a commissary for your sauces? And is that some, I mean, because that's kind of part of the problem. I don't know if you know the Fig and Olive story of 2 years ago. Fig and Olive came down here mm-hmm. and a bunch of people got sick here because there was a bad sauce, but that sauce was also in California and in New York.
Yeah.
So people got sick all across the country and nobody knew that they had this huge commissary mm. where they were making sauces. And
they said everything was fresh. That's right. the other thing.
You know,
they were telling everybody it was made on the site.
You know, you're paying
site.
$44 for right. their paella, but it's really just, you know, it's sous vide.
Sure.
Not that there's anything wrong with it, but...
But don't
Good
tell
Seinfeld
them.
Good reference.
Right.
But see, that's...
right, exactly. But you understand what I'm saying. So they lost their trust right. here. Yeah, I mean, they were already on shaky ground, but they lost their trust immediately.
Yeah.
So, but I know concepts like yours, financially, it makes sense to do a commissary.
Sure. We have a commissary.
Okay.
So in Philadelphia, we have a commissary. We're doing deliveries, what, 5 days a week, 4 days a week?
Yeah, four.
4 days a week. We're constantly churning out products. And because we buy it, I'm sorry, we make it, and then we distribute it as fast as possible. But I mean, why don't you speak to some of those safety protocols that we have inside the commissary? I mean, it's like a laboratory. It's like, it's got to be spotless.
Right.
Like there's got to be temperature checking at all times. I mean, you can speak to that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for sure. Just, I mean, what Justin said, we're very careful and, you know, we take all the precautions that are necessary and, you know, we just, you know, we fly through product as well. You know, it's definitely
And what are you
fast...
making in the commissary? What, is it dressings? Is it sauces?
Yeah, we do the sauces. We do the stir-fry sauces, the salad dressings. And we do some of the proteins.
How many different kinds of sauces and salad dressings are there?
Total, there's 13. And then we fabricate and cook and distribute some of our proteins as well there.
And is that done for a time-saving reason, or is that done for a cost-saving reason?
Well...
Or a little bit of both?
A little bit of both, but also the main reason... is consistency across the board, especially
that's
with the sauces.
So
and the
is
dressing.
The commissary in
Philly? That's where the idea came
yeah,
from.
So, mm-hmm. So the story of the commissary was I went to one restaurant at 4 o'clock and taste tested a bunch of stuff. We had three stores at the time. I went to the next location in Radnor and I tasted one of my favorite sauces, which are no longer there. So one of the changes Dave made.
He took away his sauce,
my
Dave.
My sauce, man. Lemon miso tahini.
Sorry.
I love that one.
Nice going, Dave.
Yeah, my bad.
Fucked it up. Congratulations.
Damn it, Dave.
That's why I'm over here in the corner.
Right. Shut up, Dave.
You're not really in the corner.
So, lemon miso tahini.
At least I'm drinking.
Beautiful sauce, working with Sum tahini. Just awesome product. And put my, you know, my spoon in. I tasted it, and it tasted like cement. And I was like, what the hell?
Right.
And the issue that we were having was sometimes I go in the kitchen, and the guy making the sauces would sometimes be following the recipe, and sometimes he'd say,
A little bit of this, a little
fuck
bit of
it.
That.
Justin's wrong. This needs more olive oil. Uh-huh. And it was completely off where the way they were putting the olive oil in wasn't, it just was causing too many problems. So we were looking for new offices at the time. We had these like tiny little offices in, you know, Philadelphia. And then ultimately we found my business partner, David. He found or had a relationship with a developer in Philadelphia, in Fishtown, where La Colombe is. And mm-hmm. you know, it's been emerging for the past few years, really cool area. And rent's cheap. So we found a big warehouse. We said, you know what? Like, we could not only put a commissary here, but we could also put our kind of offices here. So there's two birds, one stone. And I knew that the sauces and dressings need to be consistent. You know, right. They're not rocket science recipes, but, you know, they're recipes. And when people, and I've seen this more often than not, you leave them alone sometimes, they're going to take creative liberties.
Man.
And I'm all for people being creative, but, you know, we have a formula that works. And so I really wanted that consistency, and that's where the commissary.
Well, then what do you do for the D.C. area?
Commissary.
Comes from the commissary.
Where's that?
Philly.
Philly.
We have a so, yeah, we Sprinter van comes down.
We drive it
a few times a week. We're dropping stuff off and bring it back up.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know, the challenge is in our Boston, Chicago, and Pittsburgh stores, we don't. So we have to rely on our people to make it, and luckily
so
you're
not
good.
You don't, so the commissary does not provide to those properties at
correct.
This time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
is
well,
there
it's
a
not
larger...
going to be that fresh if it's coming from Philly to Chicago.
Well, people ship. I mean, people
we,
do.
We
that.
Didn't want to ship it. We're not putting preservatives in our
right,
stuff.
Right, right.
And it's still
and
really
logistically,
fresh.
It'd be a little crazy. Those are long drives.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a shelf life on there, and you know, we have a good product, and we don't want to fuck with it, and I don't want to whore out our product by putting additives and crap in there.
Poor.
So.
You don't want to
be whore it out. But,
so what is the plan for Honeygrow? So how many properties do you have right now?
We have a total of 26 open.
Okay.
So last one we opened was Rockville, Maryland.
Woohoo!
Doing great. Rockville's been awesome.
And Pike? Pike and Rose?
Pike and Rose.
Mid-Pike.
No, it's...
Montrose. Montrose Crossing.
Correct.
Okay.
That's where it
Thank
is.
Thank you, Courtney.
Off the Pike.
Yes.
She knows her Pike.
Yeah.
She's good. And we're opening the next one. It's going to be Schaumburg, Illinois. And we're opening up something, or a new concept called Mini Grow.
Oh, right.
We're opening one of those in the Loop in Chicago. So I'm pretty excited
what
about
that. What is Mini
well. Grow? How do you say Mini Grow succinctly? Mini Grow is the smaller version of Honey Grow. We had a bunch of ideas for our menu, and I had a lot of challenges trying to jam Honey Grow into urban spaces. You need mm-hmm. black iron or precipitator unit, and we wanted something where we could really maximize and streamline our throughput. So I took Honey Grow, scaled it down tremendously. Honey Grow is 89 ingredients. Mini Grow is 36.
Where in the Loop?
Wabash, 28 South Wabash.
Know where
and
it is.
And so, but do you feel that the people of Chicago know enough of who Honey Grow is to appreciate a scaled down concept of it?
I don't. Yeah. So to your point, I don't think enough people know about Honey Grow in Chicago yet. And
okay.
that's kind of an opportunity for us. We're going to be putting something new that I think will be great. I mean, we opened three in New York and Manhattan. They're doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And we opened over there. I think it's going to generate a lot of conversation. And I think it's going to really build brand awareness for the concept overall. At the end of the day, we have one company, Honey Grow LLC. Mini Grow is kind of like the sister version of Honey Grow and designed really for when we have a piece of real estate. I mean, DC is a great example. A lot of times we'll look at real estate and Honey Grow is actually, I'm sorry, Mini Grow is ventless. So we're not doing... there's no black iron. Like at
sure.
Honey Grow, there's, you know, we're cooking wok stuff. Excuse me. I went to Dave and said, you know, this is now, I guess, 2 years ago almost. Yeah, 2 years ago. We sat at the Cherry Hill Whole Foods. And I said, I got this idea. I want to do a smaller version of Honey Grow, streamlined version, no tech, no bullshit, just really amazing food. And the problem that I had was, do you guys remember Shop House, the Chipotle?
Yeah. It died. It failed.
I fucking hated it. It was like, if you're
going to
have
a... But it failed miserably.
So... I really wanted it to succeed because
right.
it was like a cool idea. And like I went in there, I went to the DuPont one. It was
but they
ago.
Also did not explain the concept. People couldn't figure out what they were supposed to do in there.
There's a lot of stuff. And
right.
it was kind of like
very confusing and overwhelming.
Right. And so if the product's not good, then forget it. So I'd go in there, the one at DuPont, and I got these chilled rice noodles
mm-hmm.
and they weren't good. And I was just like, yeah. So how do you do something that's going to be assembly line and actually have the noodles be delicious? And I said to Dave, like, how do you do that? And how can we cook all of our products and not require the black iron? So Dave, to his credit, figured it out and made the menu for Mini Grow. And it's pretty badass. I love it.
So you're going to open that one first
in
Chicago.
We've opened three in New York City. So we have...
Mini Grows.
Yeah, three Mini Grows.
Okay, so they're up and running. And yep. are you planning on bringing one to D.C.?
We're looking around, yeah. We were looking around.
It's hard for... Because with D.C., the biggest... I mean, you already know this.
Yep.
Everything's new.
Yep.
All the space is new.
Yep.
And everybody wants something big.
So the problem with D.C. was, with Honey Grow, we looked at a lot of real estate, and a lot of the time, landlords like, look, we love you guys, but can't vent the space. Can't vent the space. And now it's like, great, we don't need to rent the space. Cool, we figured out that problem. So really, it opened up our white space opportunities that we could be doing a bit more, and at the same time, really be having a really awesome product behind it. So I'm proud of that.
Well, I'm sort of curious how, one of the things I really wanted to talk to you guys about, and the show is almost over, is how does a concept like yours, even though it's terrific and it hits sort of all the like marketing points, you know, it's organic, it's healthy, it's fast, it's casual, it's got all those things, it's the right price point. But how does it enter into the DC market, which has not one, not two, but like five or six local fast casual brands that have a lot of loyalty, everybody from Am Pizza to Taylor to Cava to Sweetgreen and Beefsteak, Jose Andres concept. Yeah. So how do you come here and sort of ingratiate yourself to the DC clientele? And not only that, how do you put yourself in front of the right real estate properties? Because these guys and girls are on it.
So to answer the first part of that question, there's a lot of amazing concepts that came from DC. Shout out to Taylor Gourmet and Casey Patton, who's a friend of mine, and their sandwiches are awesome.
From Philly originally.
Yep. So, you know, I think it's not just a DC thing, but I think it's a bigger question about the business. And I think that so I'm seeing the same trends in every market. The challenge with DC is vertical density. So you look up in DC, you're capping out at whatever the
13 stories.
Yeah. Right. So that's it. So you can't really, you're going to have a million concepts in DC, but how much supply, I mean, how much demand is there ultimately when all you're doing is increasing your supply? And one of the challenges I think that landlords have, and we were just talking about this before the show, is Amazon has destroyed retail.
Right.
So if I'm a landlord, what am I going to do? Put in food or fitness? And so, you know, you're going to have the new concept that, you know, two kids, we always talk about this, but two kids sitting in a Georgetown or GW dorm room are coming up with this concept that's going to be Green Bowls. And we're going to be competing for that real estate at the same time.
Well, there's a difference in DC because what you've got, because of the riots in 68, which is a long time ago, you've got parts of the city that were dead for decades. And now you've got neighborhoods in the city that were traditionally dead that are opening. Bloomingdale's a perfect example.
Or Navy Yard.
Or the Navy Yard.
Yeah.
With that, so that core downtown space.
Or the Wharf.
And there's a lot of density. Well, the Wharf's different. The Wharf's not an old neighborhood that came back. The Wharf is a brand new thing.
I know, but there's areas in D.C. that never, like,
but I'm talking about in some of these neighborhoods where you can still hit a home run, and you've got older, you know, just older physical plant where you can find space.
Right. So, you know, the challenge remains, though, inside these new neighborhoods like the Navy Yard, there's so much fast casual there already, and the rents are really high. So we're all competing for the same guest base. We're competing for the same employees. And the rents are effed up.
Do you mean over in Navy Yard or over by Nats Stadium? I guess it's kind of, they're kind of broken up.
That's the same thing, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, yes. And so that's the problem. And it's not just in D.C. It's in Chicago and Boston. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that we're at the same point in the cycle as a lot of our peers. And we're all competing for the same real estate. Plus the local guys are competing for real estate. And I think the consumer might become ultimately overwhelmed with options. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few years.
Oh, but that's true. I mean, it's like lemmings in a way. I mean, at some point, when a just call it a thrust, a dining thrust becomes very popular and a lot of people jump in, there's always a winnowing out process because
well, a pendulum swing.
Totally.
People can't compete, or they're not as good, or they're really not telling the truth. You know, the word organic is another word that gets footballed all over the place.
Yeah, and we're not all organic. I mean, we have organic, we have some stuff, and, you know, but a lot of people use that word like it's like the savior word.
They hit you over the head with it.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to go back to your point about retail and its demise.
Right.
But, you know, over the last couple of years, there's been a couple of these, like, mass openings of stores that then massively close. Like, Kitten Ace, to me, is like, I'm always fascinated by that example.
The HBO at my office,
You know, they opened up internationally overnight and then also closed internationally overnight.
Yeah.
Is there a saturation point for your concept in that? Do you want to be like the old McDonald's way where there was a McDonald's on every corner or a Starbucks on every corner? Or do you feel like you want to be a little special? And I don't know if that matters in the fast casual space, but do you want to be a little special and have just a couple of neighborhoods?
I think to answer your question, I think, yes, we want to be special. We're only opening, but, you know, we're opening 10 to 11 restaurants this year and we could have opened 20. And, you know, I chose not to simply because there's so many openings going on all over the place and the rents are out of control. So to answer your question, like, I'd rather be special. And to have one in Rockville, we're opening Tyson's in Reston. That's pretty much it. You know, if we find a really good opportunity for mini-grow inside the district, we'll definitely get after it.
Which that probably makes the most sense.
Right. Otherwise, my foot is not fully on the accelerator to blow this thing out of the water. I'm very lucky that we have patient investors. They get it. They also understand the landscape. And quite frankly, I want to be here in 10 years. I want to be here in 20 years. I don't want to be like, open up a bunch of restaurants, build a crazy valuation and cash out and fuck you guys. Like, you know, with all the money we've raised, I've taken zero off the table. I'm in this for the long game and it's like a baby to me. So I don't need to do 20 restaurants this year. I don't need to do 30 restaurants this year. I'm taking it from a way more intelligent approach. And quite frankly, I love the idea when people like, we have Honey Grow in Hoboken, we have a Honey Grow in Brooklyn. And when people are like, wait, what's this mini grow place? And like, holy shit, I fucking love Honey Grow. They're in Hoboken. Oh, they're in Philly too. Cool. But we want to create that level of excitement, like a genuine level of excitement and a genuine passion. That's the best way, to be a brand like that is my goal.
Well, the key is quality control too.
Quality control, training, systems, processes, people. I mean, yep. People, product, and experience. That's it. Like, worry about the best people. You know, get the focus on training these guys to have a great product and execute a great experience over and over again. I mean, that's the hardest part. And if we were building 20 restaurants this year, you know, we're worrying about just opening instead of just like perfecting what we do. And you know what? We have a lot of room for improvement. We acknowledge that. So I'd rather be focusing on both intelligently than just, you know, blowing out the concept and getting screwed down the road.
Makes sense. Now, all right.
Before we wrap up, I just have one last question for you. When it comes to choosing your real estate locations.
Yes. I'd answer your second part of the
question. Okay. Yes. Do you prefer suburban versus city? What's better for your concept?
Well, it's interesting. When I created the concept, I didn't really think suburbs. I thought this is kind of like, I had two business plans. I had one for Center City, Philadelphia, and I had one for the University of Pennsylvania, and Center City opened up, so we used that one. What we found out is Honey Grow works well in urban areas, but the challenge is the cost to build in urban areas is really high.
The rents are insane.
And the rents are fucked up. So what we're doing is we're building the mini grows in the dense urban areas where we can really do more throughput during daytime, take less space, so we're not paying as much rent, and ultimately do the Honey Grows in the burbs. And, Honey Grow, which is open in Rockville, is doing great. Honey Grow in the burbs as well traditionally. And the strategy would be a hub and spoke model. You know, mm-hmm. Do your mini grows in the dense urban areas. Honey Grows in the burbs. You do a lot of cross branding. So you have your spicy garlic sauce and mini grow as a condiment. You have one app for both Honey Grow and mini grow. So you go to mini grow for lunch in Madison Avenue. You go, you know, you live in, let's say, Brooklyn Heights. And you're doing, well, Brooklyn's kind of the city, but still, you know, let's say we're
open.
We get
what you mean.
Exactly. Somewhere in North Jersey, you go home and boom, you could use your Honey Grow app and, you know, everything kind of works together. That's the idea.
All right. So let's make sure everybody knows how to find Honey Grow online because that's the, talk about the hub.
Yep, honeygrow.com. Also check out minigrow.com. Sister brand of Honey Grow. We'll be opening up one mini grow in Chicago. We're opening up one in Back Bay, Boston, Boylston Street. Actually, two in Boston, and if we find the right thing in D.C., I'd love to get after it. So,
how about Kensington, Maryland? That's a nice spot.
There's not a lot of good spaces in Kensington, Maryland. Well, we want to thank you both for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Team from Honey Grow in studio on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. Next week, we have Michael Weissman in. She is the queen of coffee. She's going to be talking.
I'll be awake for that.
I know. You'll be totally awake for that.
I've only had 14 cups
Join us
today.
Next week at 5. Nice. We'll be here.
All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.